Welcome to The Week Ahead in Russia, a Radio Free Europe podcast on developments in Russia, its war against Ukraine, and its relations with the rest of the world. I'm Steve Gutterman, editor for Russia, Ukraine, and Belarus in the Central Newsroom at RFERL, and author of The Week in Russia newsletter. My guest today on The Week Ahead in Russia is Mark Galeotti, an analyst of Russian politics, an honorary professor at the UCL School of Slavonic and East European Studies in London, and the author of several books, including We Need to Talk About Putin and The Weaponization of Everything, as well as Putin's Wars from Chechnya to Ukraine. And now Mark is also co-author with Anna Arutunyan of a new book called Downfall, Prigozhin, Putin, and the New Fight for the Future of Russia. While it seems to me like it was ages ago, June 23rd to 24th marked 1 year since Prigozhin's mutiny, when forces from his mercenary group, Wagner, seized control of the Russian military headquarters for the war in Ukraine in Rostov-on-Don, and a separate group, I believe, marched toward Moscow, posing a huge challenge to President Vladimir Putin. Prigozhin called off the rebellion after reaching a murky agreement with the Kremlin, but 2 months later, he was killed in a highly suspicious plane crash. Today, we're going to talk about the ramifications of those developments a year ago and how they may continue to reverberate in Russia for some time. And I also want to discuss Russia's war against Ukraine more directly, particularly in light of some of the developments outside Russia and Ukraine, including new pledges of Western support, the uncertainty stemming from elections in the U.S. and France, among others, and the pact that Putin signed with Kim Jong-il during his first visit to North Korea since 2000. Thanks very much for joining me, Mark.
Oh, always a pleasure.
All right. It's great to have you on the show again. Let's talk about Wagner and Prigozhin first. At least publicly, the main target of Prigozhin's criticism and of the mutiny itself was not Putin, but Defense Minister Sergei Shoigu, who's now been moved to the Security Council, and the Chief of Staff of the Armed Forces, General Valery Gerasimov, who remains in that post, at least for now. Prigozhin accused them of badly mishandling the war against Ukraine. But Putin is the commander-in-chief of the Russian military, of course, and the Wagner Rebellion was a major challenge to his authority. And as it unfolded, and for at least some time after it was over, there were quite a few predictions, I think, that this would or could be Putin's downfall, that it was pretty much over for him, or at least the beginning of the end. But obviously, Putin remains in power a year later. He started a new presidential term in May, a six-year term, and Prigozhin is dead, killed, many believe, at Putin's behest. Mark, your book is titled Downfall, which I assume refers to Prigozhin's downfall. Could you talk about the ramifications of Prigozhin's mutiny, the Wagner mutiny, both, I guess, now and potentially in the future? Is Putin weaker than he was before it happened or stronger? And maybe you could elaborate a bit on another part of the title of the book. What is the new fight for the future of Russia, and how deeply do Prigozhin and his fate fit into that?
Okay, thanks very much. Look, I know you had Kirill Shamiev on talking in part about the Prigozhin mutiny last week, so I'll try not to repeat issues that he raised. But I would actually want to start by disagreeing with one thing he said, was he viewed this mutiny as an attempt to overthrow Putin, and I don't think it was. I definitely think it was an exercise, frankly, in coercive negotiation. A classic Renaissance Middle Ages mercenary behavior. You march on your employer, not because you wish to topple the employer, but generally because you just want to renegotiate your contract. In his case, it was to try and get Putin to support him over Shoigu and Gerasimov. So in that context, in the context that this was actually not an attempt to topple the regime, but in some ways to leverage it in a way that, for example, Ramzan Kadyrov has done successfully over the years, I think that the irony is that Putin won, but in the way he won, he further weakened himself. Let's think about it. I mean, this is definitely a crisis. There's no question about that. And this is a regime which is, on the whole, fairly strong but brittle, I would say. In other words, it's good at handling the day-to-day. If one looks at, for example, the strains and stressors of the war, special military operation, I mean, it is clearly handling them. It's recruiting enough people to be able to maintain its combat operations without having to have another mobilization wave. The economy has been reoriented to a war-fighting economy, and although there are issues about the potential overheating and so forth, but nonetheless, you know, it's managing. Certainly for the foreseeable future, it can continue to keep up this pace. However, what the regime is not so good at is precisely dealing with the unexpected shocks, which, frankly, there will always happen in politics. Because, in my opinion, the three crucial assets on which it has always depended to deal with the unexpected shock: firstly, Putin's personal legitimacy. Secondly, his capacity to throw, you know, in practical terms, unlimited amounts of money at problems. And the final backstop, his control over the security apparatus. Well, all three of those are now looking a lot weaker. First of all, Putin's personal legitimacy. Yes, he survived this mutiny, but frankly, that shouldn't surprise. But on the other hand, this whole system is built upon around the games of divide and rule. This is how Putin controls his court, his senior figures. He pits them against each other. And he's actually proven to be pretty good at that over the years. I would say that although I think Putin is much less impressive a figure than many people would suggest, one thing he really does demonstrate is his capacity, or has demonstrated in the past, is precisely his capacity to manage these intra-elite disputes. This time, though, even though people for a long time have been warning him that the Prigozhin-Shoigu feud was becoming dangerous, he failed to handle it properly. And the point is, this is the one job that only he can do. He would suffer a dramatic loss of his authority if other people were able to be stand-ins for this role. So the very fact that the mutiny happened was a failure of Putin's. He, in effect, in classic form, panicked, first of all disappearing from view, and then so desperate was he to actually end this mutiny that he basically gave Prigozhin too good a deal, which is one of the reasons why Prigozhin was then killed, because it was kind of, in effect, Putin renegotiating that deal. But again, the elite can see that. The man who was a traitor one day was then invited to tea at the Kremlin, was then continuing to expand his operations, and was then killed. This is not because that was the first opportunity Putin had to kill him. It was clearly that Putin changed his mind. And again, that's important because it's the first time that Putin has actually reneged on a deal with an insider. It's one thing to break international law and lie to your antagonists or to your people, but there has always in the past been that sense that if you make a deal with Putin, Putin will actually feel bound by it. Well, no more. So on the one hand, I think Putin's authority within the elite is reduced. Yes, no one's going to mess with him at the moment, precisely because he had Prigozhin killed. But there's a difference between the awkward acquiescence around a murderous dictator and the sense that he is, in fact, your legitimate boss. So I think Putin's legitimacy has taken a hit. The money clearly is much more constrained now because of the needs of the war. And in terms of Putin's control of the security apparatus, it was clear that actually much of the machinery of power was actually willing to basically sit out the mutiny and just see what happened, that they did not immediately move to protest their support for Putin. They did not immediately sort of mobilize forces to block the flying column that was heading towards Moscow. You know, so in this respect, the first real test we've had of Putin's authority and legitimacy within the security apparatus, it was clear that it was found wanting. They're not turned against him, but if anything, frankly, they were happy just to sit this one out. So yes, I think Putin is now weaker. And that feeds into the sort of last point you raised about why the new fight. Well, obviously, some might suggest it's because publishers like to have exciting subtitles. But we've always thought, and certainly until relatively recently, rightly so, that the real political struggle was between Putin and his more authoritarian, nationalistic, and so forth tendencies, and a liberal opposition who wanted to see a westernizing movement. Well, I think what we're now seeing is, I mean, that obviously Navalny himself is dead. His movement inside Russia has essentially been destroyed. And although there are still many people who cleave to his views and his vision of the beautiful Russia of the future, nonetheless, actually, in many ways, we're now seeing an alternative flank open up, which is precisely the opposition to Putin from the right, from the nationalist wing, from the so-called turbo patriots. It's one of the reasons why, for example, Igor Strelkov, Girkin, who for so long had been given almost a privileged status, this, you know, ultra-nationalist figure, the man who by his own account pulled the trigger on the war in the Donbass, and who'd been tremendously critical, not just of the obvious targets of people like Shoigu and Gerasimov, but also of Putin, or as he puts it, our unique strategic advantage. For a long time, he had apparently had license to continue his criticisms, precisely because he was a pressure vent, because there's a lot of people, especially within the security apparatus, who shared his views. After the mutiny, it's quite striking that Strelkov was arrested. He's now in prison. He's just had his appeal disallowed. And so, you know, it definitely looks as if he will be being convicted and sent to prison. No great surprise there. But generally, what Prigozhin did, after all, was in many ways do one of the most dangerous things within an information control autocracy, which is, at the end of his life, begin to tell the truth about the war, about its failures. But also, and I don't want to make too much of this because, you know, Prigozhin was, a thug, self-interested, corrupt businessman and so forth. He wasn't in any way some kind of shining figure of a revolutionary. But nonetheless, what he did highlight was precisely this vacuum at the heart of the Putin system, the Putin state-building project. They can play around with trying to build ideologies in purely pragmatic terms, which are simply ways of mobilizing the Russian masses. But when it comes down to it, this regime believes in nothing but itself. It has its imperial adventure in Ukraine for its own reasons, but it doesn't really have anything at its heart. And this is something that, unfortunately, the turbo patriots are both aware of and trying to fill. So I think whereas in the past we saw this perhaps as a two-sided fight between the state and the liberals, now I think we have to recognize that it's much more of a triangular conflict between an essentially pragmatic, ruthless, self-interested state and two alternative visions for the future of Russia. Now, I very much hope that the liberal vision wins. And interestingly, there are some strange connectivities between the two. I mean, if you look at the program that, for example, Strelkov once was advocating, it actually incorporated notions about checks and balances and independent judiciary and the like. But nonetheless, you know, again, when it comes down to it, at heart, these are very different poles. But that is the sort of the difference, the way that this war in many ways has galvanized this alternative source of opposition. Because these are people who thought that Putin was their guy. And now they have actually seen that, yes, Putin may have done what they would like to see, which is to sort of reach out Russia's hand. But the degree of incompetence and corruption and half-heartedness, from their view, that has been demonstrated, has led many of them actually to question Putin's real credentials as the champion of the Russian state.
All right. Thank you, Mark. That's fascinating and chilling, I would say. Now, Prigozhin's troops, including many recruited from prisons across Russia, were fighting in Ukraine, many of them in the Donbass. And Wagner suffered extremely heavy casualties in the battle for Bakhmut. This figured into the mutiny because Prigozhin accused the military leadership of withholding weapons and ammunition from them, essentially, if I recall correctly. Russia did seize Bakhmut, but the war is still raging in the Donbass and elsewhere. And one of Putin's main goals at the moment seems to be to occupy the Donetsk region in its entirety. Now, after an unsuccessful Ukrainian counteroffensive last year, and with U.S. weapons supplies on hold amid wrangling in Congress over the winter, Russia entered 2024 with the clear advantage in the war. In recent months, though, the U.S. did approve a $61 billion aid package, And in recent weeks, Western countries agreed on a $50 billion loan for Ukraine. And the United States and other nations have concluded bilateral security pacts with Kyiv. And a NATO summit in Washington next week will bring new expressions, at least, of support for Ukraine. On the other hand, upcoming elections add to uncertainty over the future of Western support for Kyiv. In the United States, President Joe Biden's unimpressive performance in last week's debate against former President Donald Trump, who's been criticizing the amount of aid provided to Ukraine, underscored that uncertainty. And now in France, the far-right national rally has a strong lead after the first round of elections this weekend and could potentially win a majority in parliament in the second round next Sunday. So there's a possibility that France could have a far-right government for the first time since World War II. And also on the other side of Russia, Putin's pact with North Korean leader Kim Jong-il has added to concerns in Kyiv and the West, as well as in South Korea and Japan, I guess, about the potential effect of North Korean military support for Russia on the invasion of Ukraine. Mark, I'll keep the question itself short and just ask you what you make of these developments. Are they likely to bring major change in fortunes on the battlefield in the war as it goes on?
Yeah, I see what you did there. Short question, but only because it has a five-paragraph preamble. if I'm going to give you a short answer, the answer is no. However, I suspect that you and your listeners would want a little bit more than that. So, I mean, just to unpack that a bit. I mean, first of all, you talk about the role of Wagner in terms of seizing Bakhmut and the continued push to try to occupy the Donetsk region in its entirety. And that seems to be the sort of the current tactical goal. But I think it's worth just dwelling on that for a moment, because I think often there is a rather glib assumption that somehow Russia has minimalist goals or maximalist goals, and that therefore it will accept nothing less than that. I think what it's fair to say is Russia continues to have maximalist desires. I mean, on balance, would they like to see essentially all of the Donbass, the areas and the areas that they've claimed to have annexed under their direct control, the rest of Ukraine under a essentially proxy or puppet government, or at the very least having accepted all sorts of peace terms which would essentially hobble it, small army, no membership of any foreign alliances, etc.? Yes, of course. Does that mean that is the only thing that they would accept? No. I mean, they're fully aware that ultimately it's the facts on the ground that will determine the outcome of any eventual somewhere over the horizon peace talks. And that's why I think precisely the attempt to push to occupy all of the Donetsk region is so important. They would like to be able to start from that position of strength. They're aware that basically where their troops are, it's a lot harder for any negotiations to have them pushed out. So that's what's going on. I mean, I think we have to realize it's all part of an incremental, essentially, let's see how much we can grab so that we can grab all the more in any peace negotiations. Now, in terms of the various developments and their impact, I mean, broadly speaking, my view is that the US and EU, and indeed UK, pledges are enough at the moment to, as it were, reverse the situation that obtained in the first part of the year, in which absolutely Ukraine was very much on the back foot. You know, it will still take some time for these various pledges to actually become sort of operational on the ground. But nonetheless, they absolutely are important, but they're not war winners. They are, shall you say, defeat avoiders in that respect. And still so much depends on quite what happens in US and European politics. I mean, we have multiple elections. We've seen with Donald Trump, and again, it's fascinating actually if one looks at the Russian coverage of the recent car crash of a presidential debate, that on the one hand, there is a certain smug satisfaction at the claim that it was essentially a soap opera of pensioners did I think strike home. But also, in some ways, there's a slight degree of caution and concern, the sense that President Biden did so badly so early in the campaign makes it more likely, I don't know if it's likely, but certainly more likely than it was before, that actually he will be encouraged or pushed to step down as candidate, and someone who's more likely to be able to beat Trump will be parachuted in at the last moment. Because I think it's clear that the Russians would like to see Donald Trump as the American president, not because they necessarily think he's going to be sort of so much on their side, but he's making, from their point of view, the right noises about needing to push Kyiv into negotiations. But more to the point, he will be disruptive. Remember, from the Russians' point of view, there's the limit to how much they expect any particular new political leader to be on their side. They are aware that the sort of the pressures of consensus tend to bear down on any mavericks and force them into line. And that even applies to an American president, who, after all, has to consider Congress, who has to consider his own staff, the wider sort of world opinion and such like. But it's more that what they would like to see is the West paralyzed. Paralyzed by divisions within countries and between countries, so that it is unable or unwilling to provide the kind of broad-based economic, military, and political support that Ukraine needs to continue this war. So this is where Trump comes in, because if you're looking for disruption, I mean, he is absolutely the disruptor in chief. And he will also provide all kinds of new opportunities for Russian diplomacy and disinformation to be able to sort of open existing fault lines. I mean, the irony is that if Trump does win the election, I would imagine we will be seeing Russian political operations through exactly online media and such like, precisely to try and tell the Democrats that you was robbed. Because from their point of view, they don't really care who they support, whose voices they magnify, as long as ultimately they're disruptive ones. And this also applies, I would suggest, with the French elections. Again, Le Pen's position there is much more mainstream than it has been in the past. There doesn't seem to be any strong expectation that a France that is dominated, or at least even has a very powerful voice coming from Le Pen and her National Rally Party, is going to suddenly break with the mainstream and say, we're not going to be supporting Ukraine anymore and things like that. But first of all, anything that clips Emmanuel Macron's wings is good news from the Kremlin's point of view, because Macron has at the moment been trying to sort of present himself as the hawkiest of hawks in Europe, talking about sending ground troops and the like. A lot of this is frankly political posturing rather than anything else, but still the Russians would like to see Macron punished for that, and also his opportunities to actually make good on any of his claims limited. But more to the point, a Le Pen victory, or even, frankly, a really strong showing, as it seems like after the first round of elections that we're already going to be getting, is going to be disruptive, because it's going to create dismay, it's going to create recriminations, and in some ways it's going to at least partially paralyze France, a key member of the European alliance, which is very different, after all. You know, there is another major European election coming up. This week we have in the UK general elections. And here, I mean, it's a foregone conclusion that the opposition Labour Party are going to win. The only question is really just how massive a majority do they win. But the interesting thing is they are very, very much committed to exactly the same policies as the likely outgoing Conservative Party. So in that case, this is probably unlikely to have any kind of opportunity, present at least in the short term, any kind of opportunity to Moscow. So from their point of view, exactly when they look at Western politics, it is precisely with an eye to how does it provide opportunities for them to magnify existing disagreements and rivalries in order to minimize the support for Ukraine. Because, and if I can continue to move it closer and closer to the battlefield in your question, this is it. You ask a 5-paragraph question, you can expect a 10-paragraph answer. If one looks at actually how this plays out, this year we pretty much know what is likely to happen. I say likely, all wars are unpredictable. This war has proven to be in many ways more unpredictable than most. But nonetheless, the Russians are likely to continue for most of the year, continue the rest of the year, to have the advantage on the battlefield, but not a decisive one. They will continue to inch forward here and there, take a village here, take a sort of an apartment block there, take a lot more territory, frankly, than the Ukrainians are able to claw back, but they're not going to be taking Kharkiv. they're not going to be making any major gains. It doesn't look as if likely as if they're going to suddenly have a breakthrough of the Ukrainian lines, which would then allow them to sort of really exploit that massively. Really, the question is, what's going to happen next year? At the moment, we have what we could call a dynamic deadlock. So the front lines move back and forth. There are attacks, there are counterattacks, so it's not as if nothing is happening, but it's not really changing the situation on the ground. There is, at the moment, it seems to be the intent for another Ukrainian counteroffensive next year, once they've had a chance to, you know, metabolize the new kit they're getting, like F-16 jets, and work out how it's going to work in their sort of wider battle plans. And also the gap between the depth of magazines has been equalized slightly. I mean, you mentioned North Korea. I really don't put much faith in the importance of the agreements and things. What matters is a purely transactional relationship in which the Russians have just had received another 5 million artillery rounds in return for technology and wheat and energy. That's the kind of nature of their relationship. It's just simply, you know, who can provide what. But the point is that continues to allow the Russians at the moment to have the advantage. By the end of this year, the idea is that European in particular, but also American, production plans will have started to really bear fruit, that although the Russians are likely to still have more ammunition availability than the Ukrainians, the gap will be that much closed, much closer. And so the Ukrainians may have a chance to launch some kind of new counterattack next year. If that manages to change the arithmetic of the battlefield, then maybe there will be the chance for talks if the Ukrainians feel they're in a stronger position to actually be able to dictate the kind of terms that they want. If it proves, frankly, as underwhelming as the previous counteroffensive, then actually it leaves the Russians in quite a sort of strong position. But this is the point. I mean, at the moment, all we're talking about is a whole variety of measures to keep Ukraine in the battle while it's able to form new units, take advantage of its new law on military manpower, take in the additional weapons, you know, from tanks to missiles to planes that are being provided by the West, and build its plans for next year. So I would say, really, this is all just sort of holding the line. Next year will be the crucial one.
All right. Thank you very much. And I'm just going to ask a follow-up question on that. Thanks for the 10-paragraph answer. All of it very valuable, I think. You mentioned, you know, this year, probably no huge change. You know, next year is probably the big year. Could the result of the French elections, given what else is going on in Europe and the U.S., have a substantial effect on what does eventually happen?
I don't think so. I mean, again, first of all, we've got to consider the French political system, in which these are parliamentary elections. Frankly, this is still a very presidential system. It's a little bit like what happens when you have, let's say, a Democrat president with a Republican Congress. It causes all kinds of political problems. It's also quite a familiar sort of pattern. But on the other hand, ultimately, it's the president who is the commander in chief, the president who is going to be largely driving foreign and security policy. Well, the same is true in France. Now, OK, if we have a substantial swing to Le Pen's party in the parliamentary elections, that may well lead in due course to a shift in the presidency, though I suspect that Macron was in part calculating that then actually Le Pen's party would not be able to bring about the kind of improvements that they claim they will be able to bring, will face all the usual trouble of trying to do anything, frankly, in a modern administrative bureaucracy. And then by the time Macron's presidential term ends, Le Pen's glamour has been rather tarnished. So, you know, again, I think that there's a lot of complexities there. But the bottom line is, I don't think we're going to see France dramatically breaking ranks with the rest of Europe and the NATO alliance. What they will be is no longer necessarily so performatively at the front of the alliance, pushing further moves. But I think they will solidly be within the mainstream. I think generally looking at how Le Pen's language has moderated, looking at, for example, the similar trajectory that we've seen in Italy with Prime Minister Meloni, again, becoming much more moderate in practice than in campaigning, I think this is what tends to happen. It's this sort of way in which parties tend to get squeezed towards the overall sort of consensus. So does it matter? Well, obviously it matters a lot for France. Does it matter a lot for Ukraine? I suspect it'll turn out not to. Though, of course, I'm not an expert in French politics.
All right. Well, thanks very much, Mark, for the broad and very detailed answers. Once again, I've been speaking to Mark Galliotti, analyst of Russian politics, an honorary professor at the UCL School of Slavonic and East European Studies in London, and the author of several books, including The Weaponization of Everything, Putin's Wars from Chechnya to Ukraine, and with co-author Anna Arutunyan, Downfall, Prigozhin, Putin, and the New Fight for the Future of Russia. Mark, thanks very much for joining me.
Great to talk to you again.
All right, you too. And my name is Steve Gutterman, editor for Russia, Ukraine, and Belarus in the Central Newsroom at RFERL. This has been The Week Ahead in Russia. Our theme music is Не стреляй, or Don't Shoot, a song from the early 1980s by Yuri Shevchuk and DDT. Please be sure to check out my newsletter, The Week in Russia, which covers the latest developments in Russian politics and society, as well as Moscow's invasion of Ukraine. Subscribe by visiting www.rferl.org.